Lisa Michelle Lambert would never forget the day she met Lawrence Youngkin. It was a hot July afternoon in 1986. According to Lynn Riddle's book, Overkill, 16-year-old Lisa Michelle was at a local swimming pool with her little brother, Jeremy, when she spotted a tall, blonde, handsome lifeguard near the edge of the pool. Her family had been encouraging her to get a boyfriend for a while now, and she had finally spotted someone that she wanted to fill that role. That's when she was first introduced to a young Lawrence Youngkin, a man she would forever be intertwined with. At this point in time, Lisa Michelle was very different from the girl who would later be imprisoned for murder. Rather than a bleach blonde with blue contact lenses, she had dark brown hair and big brown eyes. But her appearance, her attitude, and even her name were all about to change. She says that when she introduced herself that day, Lawrence said, "I don't like Lisa, so you're going to be Michelle now."
Hi, strangers. This is your host, Alexa Morrissey. This is part two of the Murder of Laurie show, so if you haven't listened to part one, do so now, because we're going to jump right into it. Lock your doors and listen closely. This is Stranger in the House.
For most of 1991, 19-year-old Michelle Lambert had harassed 16-year-old Laurie Show for sleeping with her boyfriend, Lawrence Youngkin, while they were separated. Michelle had attacked Laurie twice, and she had called Laurie's house so many times that her family had to change their number. Part one ended with Laurie Show murdered in her home, and Michelle being arrested for the crime. Michelle, who was 7 months pregnant at the time, her 17-year-old friend, Tabitha Buck, and her 20-year-old boyfriend, Lawrence Youngkin, were all questioned by the police. And hours after interrogations, both Michelle and Lawrence confessed to being involved in the crime. Michelle said that she was in the apartment when Laurie died, but it was her friend Tabitha who killed her. And Lawrence said that he helped the two girls dispose of their bloody clothes. With part of Lawrence's story confirmed by the discovery of the discarded clothes and Michelle's confession to being in the apartment with Tabitha, the two girls were charged with first-degree murder, and Lawrence was charged with hindering apprehension or prosecution. As the first trial came around, it would seem like an open-and-shut case. But Michelle Lambert would change her story one more time, and it would turn everything upside down. In December of 1991, Michelle Lambert was charged with first-degree murder of 16-year-old Laurie Show. In March of 1992, 2 months after she was placed in county prison, Michelle gave birth to a baby girl at a local hospital. Lawrence Youngkin, the father of the baby, had asked to be at the hospital when Michelle gave birth, but the prison denied his request. The baby went to live with Michelle Lambert's parents, and Michelle went back to jail. Later that year, Michelle waived her rights to a jury and decided to appear before Common Pleas judge Lawrence F. Stengel. That decision was based on the fact that Laurie Show's story had gotten an immense amount of publicity, and Michelle's lawyers believed that she would not get a fair trial with a jury. When she arrived in the courtroom, she wore a pink, modest dress and was asked to be called Lisa instead of Michelle. A calculated move to separate herself from the image the judge had of her. Before the murder, Michelle had been stalking and harassing Laurie Show for months. She was angry that Laurie had slept with her boyfriend, Lawrence, while they were broken up. And a month before the murder, Laurie filed an assault charge against Michelle after she was attacked outside her work. Despite this violent history against Laurie, Michelle told the judge that it was her 17-year-old friend Tabitha who had killed Laurie. Michelle said that, yes, Lawrence drove her and Tabitha to Laurie's house that morning, but she only wanted to go talk to Laurie. Tabitha knocked on the door because they knew Laurie would never let Michelle in. And once the two girls were through the door, it was Tabitha who attacked Laurie with a knife. Michelle claimed that she was so shocked to see Tabitha slicing Laurie's throat that she had to look away. The prosecutor representing the Commonwealth, John A. Kenneth, told a different story. He explained that Michelle had devised a plan to kidnap Lori, drive her somewhere public, and humiliate her, most likely by tying her up with rope and cutting off her hair with a knife. According to several witnesses, Michelle had tried to get other girls in her social circle in on this humiliation plot. But they all told her they didn't want to be involved and actually warned Lori about Michelle's plan. This didn't stop Michelle, though. She continued to follow and harass Lori, and she eventually found someone who would help her lure Lori out into the open, Tabitha Buck. According to the prosecution, Tabitha was a troubled teen and had no issue helping Michelle with her plan. Michelle knew that Lori was never alone when she was in public, as her parents had devised a plan to always be with her because of Michelle's harassment. So the first part of her plan was to find a way to isolate Lori. That's when Michelle came up with the fake counselor call to Lori's mother. Once they knew that Lori's mom wouldn't be in the house that morning, Michelle and Tabitha planned their attack. Based on Lawrence Yonkin's testimony, the prosecution had laid out a timeline of the morning of December 20th, the morning Lori Sho was murdered. Lawrence told the judge that Michelle had woken him up early that morning. In the interview with the police, he said something to make it seem like Michelle had slept over Tabitha's house the night before. But in his official testimony, he says that she slept with him the night before at the trailer they shared, and woke him up early so that they could go pick up Tabitha before they went to Lori's house. Lawrence says that Michelle put on a pair of his black sweatpants and one of his flannel shirts. According to Lawrence, Michelle often wore his clothes at this point because she was 7 months pregnant. Lawrence and Michelle then picked up Tabitha from her house at 6:30 a.m. And then Lawrence dropped them off at Lori's house around 15 minutes later. According to Lawrence, he went to a local McDonald's at 6:50 a.m. for a drink, but had to wait 10 minutes before it opened at 7 a.m. He says once it opened, he stayed at McDonald's for 15 minutes, and then went back to go pick up Tabitha and Michelle. According to court documents, a McDonald's employee testified that Lawrence was at McDonald's that morning from 7 a.m. to around 7:15 a.m. According to the prosecution, while Lawrence went off to McDonald's, Lori opened the door for Tabitha, and then Michelle forced her way in. They tied a nylon rope around Lori's neck and attacked her with a knife as she struggled. At some point, according to the prosecution, they stabbed her in the back and punctured a lung. When the girls realized that Lori was dying from the wound, they sliced her throat to, quote, put her out of her misery. And even after that, Lori was still alive. And these girls just turned their backs and left her to bleed out. They then got picked up by Lawrence, washed their bloody clothes, and went about their day. According to Lori's mother, Hazel Sho, some of Lori's final words were, Michelle, Michelle did it. So proving that it was actually possible for Lori to speak with a slit throat was a huge part of this case. The prosecution called pathologist Enrique Pinares to the stand. Pinares conducted most of the autopsies in Lancaster County. Originally from Spain, he was trained in pathology at the Pennsylvania Hospital of Philadelphia and was currently a pathologist at Lancaster General Hospital. However, he was not board certified in forensic pathology, which requires extra training regarding homicides. Pinares described the wound to her throat as the result of more than one stroke. In order to get the size of the wound that she had, they would have had to cut her throat several times with a serrated knife. According to Pinares, the cut went from the skin of her neck to her spinal cord. The knife sliced through her Adam's apple, windpipe, and epiglottis. After the wound was explained, the prosecution asked if it was possible for Lori to speak with that kind of injury. According to Pinares, the way we speak is based on how the vocal cords close and vibrate from air exiting our bodies, along with how our tongues and mouths move. Lori's injury was higher than her vocal cords, and her tongue and lips were unharmed. So yes, according to Pinares, she could have spoken. The pathologist clarified that it wouldn't have been at a normal tone and most likely sounded like a whisper, but it would have been clear enough for someone else to hear and understand. Police testified that they had found a pink garbage bag with the clothes that Tabitha and Michelle said they wore that morning, and that they had gone down to the nearby Susquehanna River and found the murder weapon, a serrated knife. They were able to find all of this because Lawrence Youngkin had cut a plea deal. Lawrence, the man that Michelle tortured Lori over, completely sold the girls out. Lawrence testified that after he picked up Michelle and Tabitha, Michelle told him that Tabitha and Lori were wrestling and Tabitha accidentally stabbed her in the back. She said that they heard a hissing noise from her punctured lung, and that's when she and Tabitha agreed to slit Lori's throat to put her out of her misery. Lawrence then testified that the girls showered at his trailer, they took Tabitha to school, and he helped Michelle clean and dispose of the clothes and the murder weapon. Lawrence's plea deal was that he would only get 1 year in prison for testifying in Michelle's trial. But once he took the stand, the defense and the prosecution had a hard time believing that he did not know what was going to happen to Lori that day when he dropped the girls off at her apartment. Under cross-examination, Lawrence eventually admitted that he did in fact know that the girls were planning to beat Lori up when they got to the apartment. Now, because Lawrence had perjured himself on the stand, he was sentenced to 10 to 20 years in prison instead of one. At the end of her first trial, Michelle Lambert was found guilty of first-degree murder and was sentenced to life in prison. Because this was Michelle's first offense and she had recently had a baby, she was spared from the death penalty. 17-year-old Tabitha Buck pled guilty to second-degree murder and was also sentenced to life. She was given second-degree murder instead of first because despite Michelle's story that Tabitha had been the one to kill Lori, there was no way to prove that. They knew she went into the apartment with Michelle, but they couldn't say what happened inside. The same could be said for Michelle if it had not been for the fact that Michelle had motive. Michelle had a history of violence and threats against Lori. And several young witnesses testified that she had said on multiple occasions that she was planning the kidnapping and humiliation of Lori. One friend of Michelle's even testified that Michelle said that if Lori went to the police after the kidnapping, she had, quote, friends that would take care of her. Two other teenagers who knew both Lori and Michelle, Laura Thomas and Kimona Warner, testified that they had specifically heard Michelle say that she wanted to slit Lori's throat on at least one occasion. The trio was taken to prison, and Lori's parents, Hazel and John Cho, believed that it was the end of this horrible ordeal, and that their daughter Lori had finally gotten justice. But that justice would be short-lived, because in the years to come, this case would be reopened, and Michelle Lambert's fate would be very different the next time around. The Cho family's nightmare wasn't over. It was just beginning. In late 1992, Michelle Lambert was convicted of killing 16-year-old Lori Cho. Despite her conviction, she maintained that she was not the one to kill Lori, and it was in fact her friend Tabitha who was the murderer. Many, including the judge, found this hard to believe, as Michelle had been harassing Lori for months prior to the murder. Michelle had been stalking and physically attacking Lori over the fact that Lori had slept with her boyfriend and future father to her child, Lawrence Youngkin. Michelle and Lawrence had a rocky relationship, and they were broken up when Lori and Lawrence got together. But according to Michelle, the story is far more complicated than that. Lisa Michelle Lambert was born on September 9th, 1972. Just to prevent any confusion going forward, I will keep referring to Lisa Michelle as Michelle. She had dark brown hair and big brown eyes. She lived in an Amish community for most of her childhood and was described by her parents as sweet, headstrong, and independent. The Lamberts were a very religious family, and they went to Oregon Pike Presbyterian Church twice a week. They had very strict rules for their children, including no smoking, no drinking, no rock and roll music, and certainly no sex before marriage. Michelle had three younger brothers, and according to Lynn Riddle's book, Overkill, because her mother suffered from severe depression, Michelle ended up becoming their caregiver in her young teens, while her father worked to support them. Michelle was always considered smart and a great student. That is, until she got to high school. She was often bullied for being a nerd and was called various hurtful names by other students. Michelle was not from a wealthy family. In fact, she was considered very poor, and many students ridiculed her for being, quote, white trash. By the time she hit high school, Michelle had lost interest in her studies. Her grades went down, and she started sneaking out of the house to hang with her friends. When she was 16 years old, Michelle met Lawrence Youngkin. There is debate about the nature of Lawrence and Michelle's relationship, but according to Michelle's book, Love, Murder, and Corruption in Lancaster County, it was extremely abusive right from the start. Michelle claimed that Lawrence wanted to change her from the moment he met her. During their first introduction, he told her that he didn't like the name Lisa and she should go by Michelle. According to Lynn Riddle's book, Overkill, after they started dating, he told her to dye her hair bleach blonde, wear blue contact lenses, and dress provocatively because she wasn't naturally sexy enough to hold his attention. According to Michelle, Lawrence told her what to wear, where she could go, and even forbade her from learning how to drive. Michelle says she did everything he asked, but that didn't stop him from hurting her. Michelle claims that on one of their first dates, Lawrence beat and raped Michelle in his van after they saw a movie together, which, if you remember from part one, is a very similar story Lori told to her mother about Lawrence raping her. Michelle says that the morning after the event, he showed up to her house with roses and an apology. Michelle forgave him and they continued to date. Not too long after this, Michelle got into a huge fight with her mother and asked Lawrence if she could move in with him. At the time, he was still living with his parents, but they reluctantly agreed to let her move in. Lawrence was often called Butch by his family and friends, and according to Lynn Riddle's Overkill, Lawrence got the name from his biological father, who was also called Butch. But according to Michelle's book, the nickname had more gruesome implications. Michelle said that when she asked Lawrence's family why they called him Butch, his stepfather said that it was short for butcher, because Lawrence would sometimes self-harm by slicing the sides of his face with a butcher's knife. While it's debated who is telling the truth about where the nickname came from, Lawrence did later admit to this being a form of self-harm he performed when he was emotional, and he had done it in front of Michelle when they would fight. Michelle said that Lawrence continued to beat and sexually harass her over the course of their relationship. Michelle told her mother about the abuse, and her mother begged her to leave Lawrence, but she told her mother that she believed he would kill her if she ever left. Around this time, Michelle told her mother that she was pregnant, and despite her mother being deeply religious, she didn't want Michelle to stay with Lawrence. Michelle had told her mother horror stories about Lawrence. Her mother believed that he would abuse, or worse, kill her children if she stayed with him. On Easter Sunday of 1991, Michelle brought Lawrence to her parents' house to have dinner. Michelle's parents and three little brothers were all there. According to Michelle and her mom, Lawrence started a fight with Michelle and hit one of her younger brothers. It was around this point that they broke up. They had moved out of Lawrence's parents' house and were living alone in a trailer together. But after the breakup, Lawrence moved back in with his parents and Michelle stayed in the trailer. It was during this breakup that Lawrence briefly started dating a young girl named Lori Show. And that would be the beginning of the end for Lawrence and Michelle's toxic relationship. Michelle Lambert was sent to prison in 1992 for the murder of 16-year-old Lori Show. Her conviction rode heavily on the fact that she could be placed at the scene of the crime and that she had been harassing Lori over her short-lived relationship with Michelle's boyfriend, Lawrence Youngkin. According to Michelle, despite her treatment of Lori, Lawrence was not a boyfriend worth fighting for, but his constant physical and sexual abuse kept her paralyzed from ever leaving him. If Michelle's story of Lawrence's sexual abuse is true, then she would unfortunately be re-traumatized in prison. After she was convicted of first-degree murder, Michelle was sent to Cambridge Springs Prison in Pennsylvania. In May of 1993, Michelle accused a guard of sexually assaulting her. Initially, the prison didn't pursue an investigation, because based on various interviews from other prisoners and staff, it seemed as if the act was consensual. But the guard was eventually tried and convicted of aggravated indecent assault, and official oppression, because regardless if their relationship was quote-unquote consensual, he was a guard, and he was in a position of power over Michelle. Michelle also accused another guard of sexually assaulting her, but the prison determined that the claim was false, and the man was not charged with anything. After this, Michelle was moved to a prison in New Jersey. While she was imprisoned in New Jersey, Michelle began to handwrite letters containing a petition for her appeal to be brought to a federal court in Philadelphia. By 1996, two of her appeals had been denied, one in 1994 and one in 1995. Normally, the number of appeals you get are based on how many superior courts there are in your state. You can appeal to the next court that is superior to the one that denied the appeal before. In Pennsylvania, a PCRA petition is the next step if all appeals have been denied. A PCRA is an indirect appeal, essentially asking the court to reconsider the accused's conviction after a direct appeal to the superior court was unsuccessful. Once a PCRA fails, and the state court remedies have been exhausted, there is a possibility of filing a habeas corpus petition in federal court. Michelle had not filed a PCRA, but sent her petition straight to the federal court. Later that year, one of Michelle's letters caught the attention of U.S. District Judge Stuart Dotzell of Philadelphia. After reading her petition, he believed that she had a case to invoke habeas corpus, which would bring into question whether or not she had been unlawfully imprisoned. Dotzell was going to reopen the case and selected a law firm to represent Michelle pro bono. That's when Christina Rainville became Michelle's lawyer. According to Overkill by Lynn Riddle, when Rainville first looked up the case, she was preparing to defend a monster. Someone who was so clearly guilty that this case was going to be a real challenge for the lawyer. But once she got on the phone with Michelle, Rainville was convinced that Michelle was innocent. Rainville described Michelle as meek and mild-tempered. Rainville enlisted her husband, fellow lawyer Peter Greenberg, to help her on the case. Greenberg was actually the same age as Judge Dotzell, and they both went to the University of Pennsylvania for their undergraduate and law degrees, although Dotzell was admitted a year later than Greenberg. The husband and wife team, along with six associates from Rainville's firm, researched Michelle's case and filed a petition alleging false imprisonment on January 13, 1997. The basis for this petition? The team of lawyers had discovered 95 incidents of prosecutorial misconduct and police wrongdoing. 95. Rainville claimed that the Lancaster police had framed Michelle for the crime because they were trying to cover up a dark secret that would shock all of Lancaster. Michelle Lambert had spent 5 years in prison for the murder of Laurie Show, and now was finally going to get her appeal heard by a federal judge. Her new lawyer, Christina Rainville, was ready to fight Michelle's original conviction and expose a massive cover-up conducted by the Lancaster police and prosecution. Before they started the trial, Rainville had a plan to revert Michelle back to Lisa, the girl that existed before Lawrence ever got his hands on her. Like the trial before, they wanted her to go by Lisa instead of Michelle. They dyed her blonde hair back to her natural brown, lost the blue contacts, and dressed her modestly. Suddenly, the media's image of the murderous Barbie was gone, and the wholesome girl next door was ready for court. In March of 1997, Michelle, now Lisa, was back in court for her federal appeal. Judge Stuart Dotzell presided over the case. Michelle once again waived her rights to a jury, and Michelle's lawyers explained that Michelle was a classic victim of abuse and took the fall for Lawrence Youngkin. According to Michelle's lawyers, Lawrence and Tabitha were the ones who killed Laurie, and Michelle had actually tried to save her. Michelle's new story went like this. She and Tabitha were planning to pull a prank on Lori by tying her up and cutting off her hair in public. A scheme that she had been planning to do for a while, according to witnesses in the first trial. When the two girls got to the apartment, Tabitha went in and Michelle stayed outside because she knew Lori wouldn't let Michelle in because of their history. From outside the apartment, Michelle saw Tabitha attack Lori with the knife they had brought to cut her hair. Michelle claims to have rushed in, tried to stop Tabitha, and actually drag Lori away from her, but she couldn't overpower Tabitha. Michelle ran out of the house and found Lawrence coming up the stairs to the apartment. She told him that Tabitha was stabbing Lori, and then, according to Michelle, Lawrence went into the apartment to help Tabitha kill Lori. Michelle believes that Lawrence killed her because he was scared that she might bring rape charges against him, which was something that Lori's mother had threatened to do during one of their confrontations. If you remember from part one, during one of the last altercations between the shows and Michelle at a farmer's market, Lori's mother said that if Lawrence didn't stop Michelle's harassment of Lori, they were going to file rape charges against Lawrence. Although she didn't initially press charges, Lori told her mother and police officer Robin Weaver that during one of her first dates with Lawrence, he had raped her in his van, something that he had also allegedly done to Michelle. Michelle's lawyers also brought in a co-worker of Lawrence's, who said that the day before the murder, Lawrence had warned him that he might not be at work tomorrow because, quote, he had to kill someone. So to summarize, Michelle claims that she thought the plan was to humiliate Lori by possibly taking her somewhere public and cutting her hair. It was Tabitha and Lawrence who went into the apartment to kill her. And according to this new witness, this was Lawrence's plan all along because he mentioned that he was going to kill someone the day before. Because Michelle was a victim of Lawrence's long-standing abuse, she told police he wasn't involved in the crime out of fear that he would hurt her if she told the truth. Michelle's lawyers brought in domestic violence expert Ann Burgess, who would later provide expertise in the recent Gabby Petito case. According to court transcripts, Burgess testified for a full day about how Michelle had battered woman syndrome, a subcategory of post-traumatic stress disorder that is caused by repeated abuse at the hands of a partner, and often prevents the victim from leaving their abuser. Michelle testified about all the abuse she had suffered at the hands of Lawrence. And according to her, she was taunting and harassing Lori because she was trying to scare her off from Lawrence, as if to protect her. This appeal, unfortunately, brought Lori's parents back to court. And while it was hard for them to revisit that time in their lives, John and Hazel Show were not going to let Michelle get away with saying that her constant harassment and attacks on their daughter were some sort of altruistic act by Michelle to protect Lori. They once again testified about Michelle's harassment of their daughter, and at this point, Lori's mother, Hazel, had become an advocate for anti-stalking laws and even helped pass one that outlawed stalking in Pennsylvania in June of 1993. They explained that Michelle was relentless in her harassment of Lori, and that Lori was scared for her life. Despite her impassioned testimony, Hazel Show's credibility would be attacked by Rainville, and possibly for good reason. If you remember in part one, Hazel Show had gotten a call from Lori's alleged school counselor the night before the murder. When she went to the school the morning of December 20th, the counselor never showed up, and she soon realized it was a ruse to get her out of the house. When Hazel got back home, she found her daughter slowly dying on her bedroom floor, with her throat slit. According to Hazel, Lori's final words were, "Michelle, Michelle did it," and "I love you." A big part of the first trial was proving that Lori could actually have spoken to her mother with her neck injury. According to the first expert witness, it was possible. But in this 97 trial, Michelle's lawyers were ready to disprove everything that Hazel alleged her daughter said that morning. Christina Rainville referenced police reports from an interview Hazel did with Officer Robin Weaver in January of 1992. According to this report, Hazel said that she actually called Lori from the counselor's office the morning of December 20th after she found out the counselor was running late. According to Hazel, on this call, Lori told her that Michelle was in or on her way to their condo. Now, this claim that Hazel was on the phone with Michelle that morning is only mentioned in this one police report, but it was proven an indisputable lie. Phone records show that this call did not happen, and Hazel did not use the counselor's phone at all. Hazel also never mentioned this call in her testimony, but it did remain in a police report, suggesting someone was lying. Rainville alleged that this false report called Lori's final statement that Michelle killed her into question, because Hazel was the only person who heard it. Normally, Lori's mother just saying that her daughter told her that Michelle did it would be considered hearsay and not admissible in court. But because it was a dying declaration, it was treated as testimony from the victim. A dying declaration is a statement made by a person who is at the point of death, but conscious. The dying person's statement makes a connection between the individual who harmed them and the injuries suffered. But there are very specific requirements for a statement to be considered a dying declaration. The statement must be made by the victim. The victim must make the statement at the time they believe death is imminent. The victim must at least be unavailable by the time the evidence is offered at trial, although some states require the victim to be dead by the time of the trial. The statement can only be introduced in a homicide case. The statement must focus on the circumstances of the victim's death, and the statement must name the defendant or be used against the defendant. By Hazel's account, Lori's final words do fill the requirements of a dying declaration. But according to Rainville and her associates, Hazel lied about Lori's final words. In fact, she was lying about Lori being able to talk at all. The defense brought in Charles Lawson, a professor of speech at Northwestern University, as a witness. According to Lawson, Lori's vocal cords were destroyed when her throat was slit, not only preventing her from being able to speak, but rendering her unconscious right after. According to this expert, Hazel had lied about her daughter talking to her minutes before her death. When Lawson was asked about the pathologist's testimony in the first trial, he said that he believed the first pathologist was lying. This would be the first allegation of the Lancaster Police Department conducting a cover-up from the defense. According to Rainville, the Lancaster Police Department had neglected to properly investigate Lawrence Youngkin so that they could frame Michelle for the crime. Why? Because Michelle accused three of their officers of raping her in her apartment 6 months before Lori was murdered. One of the police officers Michelle accused was a man who has come up several times in this case at this point, Robin Weaver. The same officer who told Michelle and Lawrence to leave Lori alone after they stalked her outside her work. And he was one of the first officers at the scene of the crime the morning of the murder. He had also provided crucial testimony in Michelle's first trial. And he was the officer who wrote the report that said Hazel Show had called Lori the morning of the murder from the counselor's office. When Michelle, now Lisa, took the stand in this 97 trial, she said that she had met Officer Robin Weaver when she was 14 years old, while his son attended her younger brother's birthday party. According to Michelle, a couple months after he met her, he asked her out on a date, but she denied him because he was around her father's age. Over the years, Weaver had apparently continued to ask Michelle out, and she continually said no. Despite the age difference and her constant rejection of him, Michelle said that all the interactions between them were still pretty friendly. That is, until the summer of 1991. According to Michelle, this is when Weaver's advances started to get aggressive. She says he would park outside her house and demand she get in his car. She said he would constantly pressure her to go out with him. During this time, Michelle also says that she got a lot of sexually aggressive phone calls from a voice she couldn't recognize. She said the man on the other line threatened her with rape. According to Michelle's book, Love, Murder, and Corruption in Lancaster County, at one point, Lawrence answered one of these calls, and he used star 69 to figure out who was calling. For our younger listeners, before caller ID, you could dial star 69, and the phone would immediately call back the number that called you. According to Michelle, when Lawrence did this, the voice on the other end said that they had reached East Lampeter Township Police Department. After the fifth time Michelle noticed Weaver outside her house, she says she called the chief of police to tell him that she was having an issue with the officer. Because Weaver was allegedly doing this in his uniform and waiting outside her house in his police car, the chief said he would look into it, but no official report was ever made. After that, Michelle said that she didn't see Weaver for a while. On June 17th, 1991, Michelle said that after a day at the local pool, she went home and fell asleep on her couch. She says she awoke to someone approaching her front door, and she assumed it was her boyfriend, Lawrence. She then says she saw someone's arm reach through her window and unlock her front door. According to Michelle, Officer Robin Weaver and two other men, one in police uniform, later identified as Detective John Bowman, and one in casual clothes with a badge on his belt, entered her home. Michelle says they showed her that they had a gun, and all three proceeded to rape her, one after the other. As they left her apartment, she says that Robin Weaver taunted her about no one believing her if she ever told anyone what happened. When asked in court why she didn't go to the police after this incident, she responded, "They were the police." According to Michelle, she didn't tell anyone what happened, not even Lawrence. She had allegedly asked her original attorney not to bring it up in the first trial because she was worried that the police would target her family and her new baby if she did. Michelle says she didn't talk about it until she heard that Robin Weaver had mentioned her allegations of stalking and rape in his deposition at the first trial. Because here's the thing, according to Michelle, she had never officially accused him of rape until this 97 trial. So why would he bring it up in that first 1992 trial? According to Overkill, Michelle believed that the only reason he discussed it was because he knew it had happened and assumed she was going to mention it in court. When Judge Dizell heard this in the 97 trial, he asked her lawyers if this was true, and they said yes. Robin Weaver had mentioned allegations of stalking and rape in his 92 deposition. That's when Dotzell demanded that Robin Weaver be called as a witness. Once on the stand, Weaver said that Michelle had been telling people in town that he had raped and stalked her. She had not officially accused him of anything, but according to him, it was definitely a rumor that she was spreading. He also pointed out that there were many holes in Michelle's story, such as her description of the uniforms they were wearing were blue, but at the time of her alleged rape, they would have been silver. Detective John Bowman, the other man she accused, had receipts that put him out of town the day of the alleged rape. He was actually on his honeymoon as he was married 3 days before the alleged attack. Michelle denied telling anyone in town about the attack, and later said that John Bowman looked like one of her attackers, but she couldn't be 100% sure it was him. While there wasn't any definitive proof that Robin Weaver and the two other officers had attacked Michelle, Rainville still made a case for a large cover-up by the police. She said that they were trying to frame Michelle to cover for their colleagues and friends who had assaulted her. Michelle's lawyers alleged that the East Lampeter Police of Lancaster had tampered with evidence. Rainville presented a video recording of the police that had played at the first trial. Michelle's lawyers alleged that the video had been purposefully edited to hide the fact that the bag had been tampered with. In the version that was shown in the initial trial, the police are seen searching the woods and a detective can be seen motioning for the cameras to cut. The camera cuts and then the next shot is the empty pink plastic bag that Lawrence had told them about. Rainville alleged that the police had edited the video to hide what they had actually found in the contents of the bag, specifically anything that would link Lawrence to the crime. According to court documents, Rainville obtained the unedited version of the tape and played it in court. On the unedited tape, you can hear the detective acknowledge the bag that is not on camera, and then when we see it, it is ripped open and empty. Now the issue with this is not only is the bag not on screen for the whole time, but in the original trial, the detective seen in the video testified that they didn't even find a pink bag in the search. During this 97 trial, Rainville called this detective, Detective Barley, to the stand and asked him once again if he had found a pink bag during his search. Again, he said no. But when he is shown the video, he sees himself, he suggests that he must have forgotten. When asked why he is clearly motioning for the cameras to cut, he says he also doesn't remember doing that, or why. There were a pair of sweatpants found in the pink bag by the police that Lawrence had told police Michelle had worn the morning of Lori's murder. Despite the fact that Michelle also told a sergeant that she wore those sweatpants in her initial questioning, Michelle's defense argued that there was no evidence that she wore those pants that day. And now Michelle insisted that they were too oversized for her to wear. The pants were several sizes bigger than what Michelle normally wore, and they actually belonged to Lawrence. But do keep in mind that Michelle was 7 months pregnant at the time, and Lawrence had said that she was known to wear his clothes. During this appeal, the police produced a nearly identical pair of sweatpants for evidence, but not the actual sweatpants that were found in the bag. According to Rainville, these pants were actually smaller than the original, and now it suddenly looked like Michelle could have worn them. At this point, Michelle's lawyers actually accused the police of trying to keep Michelle in jail by producing these smaller pants. Rainville also insisted that the crime scene photos were staged. In one of the photos of Lori's body, a phone cord is wrapped around one of her legs. According to Rainville, when Michelle was questioned by the police, she told them that she tried to help Lori escape and that Tabitha threw the phone across the room. Rainville alleged that the police saw the phone across the room in the original photos and believed that this would make Michelle's story more believable. So they restaged the crime scene to retake the photos. According to Rainville, never once in anyone's 92 testimony was there ever mention of a phone cord. Rainville accused the police of taking Lori's body from the morgue the day of the murder and repositioning her body back at the apartment. She said shortly after 6 a.m. the next day, after Michelle's statement had been finished, the police went to the county morgue in the basement of the nursing home, took the body out of the morgue, and put it in a police car. Then they drove to the condo and met a police officer who agreed to take the pictures again. According to Rainville, they cleaned up the blood in the hallway, missed one or two footprints, but most of the blood was cleaned up. According to Rainville, the police took new pictures of the body with a telephone cord wrapped around Lori's leg to prove that Michelle's story was a lie. According to Rainville, they then put the body back in the police car, went down the highway, and brought the body back to the morgue by 9 p.m. to be ready for the autopsy the next morning. In addition to this, a story that later turned out to be a lie by a local teenager was used as evidence in the first trial. According to Lynn Riddle's book, Overkill, Laura Thomas, a teenage girl who knew both Michelle Lambert and Lori Show, had gone to the police after the murder, and according to a detective's testimony in the first trial, she explicitly said that she heard Michelle say she wanted to slit Lori's throat in the summer of 1991, months before the murder. According to Rainville, the three officers who originally interviewed Laura never wrote anything in the report about throat slitting in their notes, and it turned out that it was a fabrication of the detective on the stand based on accounts from other teens. In fact, Laura Thomas actually confessed to making up the whole story about hearing Michelle say she wanted to hurt Lori that summer, and was charged with making a false report and pled guilty to disorderly conduct in March of 1992. And yet, her report was still referenced in the first trial after she pled guilty. Michelle Lambert also told her lawyers that she was administered a polygraph and given truth serum when she was originally interrogated by the police. On the morning of December 21st, 1991, Michelle gave a statement to Corporal Raymond Salt that is now referred to as the Salt Statement. Apparently, Salt gave her a polygraph test that she consented to, and he provided two separate statements from this test. Before the polygraph, Michelle provided Salt with a handwritten statement of the alibi story, the story of the fight with the girls in the McDonald's parking lot. During the polygraph, Salt questioned Lambert about her alibi and said that he thought she wasn't being truthful. At which point, Michelle began to depart from her story, and Salt began to take a second statement from her. This statement consisted of 5.5 typed pages, each signed by Michelle at the bottom. Salt transcribed the first in hand-printed lettering and then cursive writing, signed at the bottom. According to Rainville, Salt altered Lambert's statements to include her admitting that she wore Lawrence's clothes the day of the murder. She argued that Michelle signed blank pieces of paper at her interview and didn't understand why she was doing it. She alleges that Salt filled in the blank pages afterwards and attributed it to Michelle. She supports this by alleging that Salt typed the first 5.5 pages, but handwrote the last page. She said, Salt prepared the statement on two types of paper, typing bond and cheap copy paper. The handwritten addition to the statement is fabricated. Michelle's lawyers also alleged prosecutorial misconduct in the first trial, based on the fact that Lawrence's perjured testimony was used to convict Michelle. Perjury law is centered on protecting the credibility of official proceedings, and according to Michelle's lawyers, when the court allowed Lawrence's perjured testimony to be used to convict Michelle, the credibility of the conviction was called into question. But Rainville and her associates didn't just have accusations of misconduct. They claimed they had a written confession from Lawrence. During her 97 federal appeal, Michelle's lawyers alleged that there was a huge cover-up conducted by the Lancaster police to put Michelle in jail because she had previously accused three officers of raping her. Her lawyer said that they purposefully didn't conduct a full investigation into Lawrence Youngkin because they wanted to frame Michelle for the crime. And her lawyer said that they now had proof that Lawrence was actually more involved in the crime than he originally said. A letter that Michelle and Lawrence had exchanged during their time in prison was brought into evidence at this new trial. The letter contained a list of questions from Michelle and spaces for Lawrence to write his answers. According to Michelle's lawyers, his answers were damning. Here is what's written in the letter. And for your reference, when Michelle talks about Friday, she's talking about the day of Lori's murder. Also, keep in mind that parts of the letter have been kept from the public. Michelle writes, "Listen to me. I guess I won't tell on you, but please, answer these questions honestly. These are some things I need to know if I'm supposed to take the blame for what you did. Mail these back to me. Tell truth. You only stayed happy Friday so I wouldn't get terrified of you. You did because you were sorry. I know you didn't mean to kill, and you are sorry and guilty and feel sorry for Hazel, right? Lawrence, wrong. Michelle, will you promise to love me if I lie for you? Lawrence, always and forever. Michelle, will you still stick with me as long as I still don't tell that you held down Lori for Tabby? Lawrence, will always love you. Michelle, do you promise not to beat my face up anymore if I lie for you? That's why I had said I hated you. Will you be nice like our first date? Lawrence, yes. Michelle, why weren't you sad at all on Friday after you and Tabby killed her? You were happy at Grandma's. Are you glad she is dead? Lawrence, yes, we had fun at my grandma's house. Michelle, are you sure if I take the blame for you that I'll get less time? Absolutely sure. Lawrence, yes. Michelle, should I still cover up that you helped Tabby kill Lori? Are you absolutely sure? Lawrence, yes, I'm positive. So in this letter, there is no definitive I killed Lori confession, but Michelle's lawyers claim that some of his affirmative answers to the questions were enough. The defense brought in a handwriting expert who testified that in his professional opinion, the letter was not doctored, and it was in fact Lawrence's handwriting in the response sections of the letter. It was Lawrence's handwriting in the response sections of the letter. After Michelle's testimony and the reading of the letter, Hazel Show, Lori's mother, suddenly had a memory come back to her that would unknowingly help Michelle's case. Hazel went to the district attorney in a private meeting and said she suddenly remembered that she saw Lawrence driving around her apartment the morning of Lori's murder. She told a police officer that morning that she had seen him, but the police officer told her not to worry about it. It now emerged that Hazel and a neighbor had reported seeing Lawrence that morning near the apartment, but the prosecution had failed to present this evidence at the 1992 trial. The prosecution then said they could not place Lawrence at the scene of the crime, while they could place Michelle and Tabitha there, which is why they were charged with murder, and he was not. On April 15, 1997, Judge Stuart Detzel of Philadelphia cited 25 instances of prosecutorial and police misconduct, including improperly dealing with evidence and entering a perjured testimony. That day, he said the original trial was the worst example of prosecutorial misconduct in the English-speaking world. Because of this, Detzel freed Lisa Michelle Lambert from prison and barred the state courts from ever trying her for this crime again. So after 5 years in prison, Lisa Michelle Lambert was a free woman. She was given a second chance at life and would never see the inside of a prison cell ever again. Or so she thought. Because while this is the end of part two, this story isn't over. In the following months, the FBI would be called to investigate the Lancaster police and Michelle's story of a department-wide cover-up. The Supreme Court would review whether or not Judge Detzel had the right to bar the state from retrying Michelle, and whether Michelle had the right to invoke a federal appeal at all. And what about Lawrence Youngkin? Who was the man who caused the feud between Michelle and Lori? And was he really the murderer all along? This episode was written by Alexa Morrissey, researched by Victoria Cox, and produced by Michael Morrissey, John Scassia, and Heidi Sherman. Stranger in the House is a Boy Wonder production. All our sources for this episode will be linked in the bio and on our website, strangerinthehouse.com. You can follow us at strangerinthehouse.com, @_strangerinthehouse on Instagram and TikTok, and @_strangerpod on Twitter. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.